1981 in review. 1981 was a year that saw another attempt on the life of an American president, the killing of a foreign leader, and an attack on the head of the Roman Catholic Church. The end of a long hostage drama, a continuing strain on the economy, and more trouble in the Middle East. I'm Nick Charles. A look at the year in retrospect on 1981 in review after this message.
Mildred Velez of the South Bronx remembers working with a Vista volunteer.
One of the things that we did do is enter three abandoned buildings and start to gut. This was done purely on a volunteer basis. There were no monies. There was only spirit and hope that it could be done. One of the buildings is ready to be opened in 2 weeks from now for people to start moving in.
Somebody started something here, a contagious idea. That hopelessness is just a place, a perfect place for just giving up or for rebuilding from the ground up.
One of the other things that this volunteer did was a lot of counseling in English and math. Some of the kids have obtained their high school diploma and now going to college. And I have to give the credit to the Vista volunteer for doing that.
Join Vista. It's a year that will last you forever. Call 800-424-8580. A public service of Vista, this station, and the Advertising Council.
On January 20th, 1981, 52 Americans who were held hostage in Tehran following the takeover of the U.S. Embassy finally had their prayers answered. They were going home. They had to pass through a gauntlet of Iranians screaming anti-American slogans as they headed for the plane that would take them to freedom after 444 days of captivity. After a debriefing in Wiesbaden, West Germany, they were taken to the West Point Military Academy in upstate New York, where they were reunited with their families. Bill Small was there.
The plane that carried the 52 American hostages from Iran on America's Inauguration Day didn't leave Tehran until after Ronald Reagan was president, and Jimmy Carter, who had worked for 14 months to get the hostages home, was out of office. But Carter saw the results of his efforts 2 days later in Wiesbaden, West Germany, when he met the 52 who arrived there for a few days of rest and reorientation, and where he spoke angrily of their treatment.
The acts of barbarism which were perpetrated on our people by Iran can never be condoned. It's been an abominable circumstance that will never be forgotten.
Over the next days, the hostages made their way to West Point for reunions with their families. And on January 27th, they flew to Andrews Air Force Base near Washington for a motorcade to the White House through streets choked with cheering well-wishers waving thousands of yellow ribbons. At the White House, the 52 became 53 again, with the addition of hostage Richard Queen, released because of illness. And there was a welcome from President Reagan.
You've come home to a people who for 444 days suffered the pain of your imprisonment, prayed for your safety, and most importantly, shared your determination that the spirit of free men and women is not a fit subject for barter. Let terrorists be aware that when the rules of international behavior are violated, our policy will be one of swift and effective retribution.
And a response from the chargé d'affaires at what used to be the American Embassy in Tehran, Bruce Langen.
53 Americans who will always have a love affair with this country. Mr. President, in very simple words that come from the hearts of all of us, it is good to be back. Thank you, America, and God bless all of you. Thank you very much.
But by year's end, the hostages had mostly faded from the public consciousness, with the lack of media attention a relief for many who had grown weary of their notoriety. This is Bill Small.
On January 20th, as the hostages were coming home, Ronald Wilson Reagan was being sworn in as the 40th President of the United States. Merrily Cox reports he immediately set the tone of his administration, calling for an era of national renewal.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability...
And will to the best of my ability.
High noon, January 20th, 1981. Chief Justice Warren Burger administers the oath of office to Ronald Reagan, the 40th President of the United States. It is a ceremony with the usual fanfare befitting a presidential inauguration, the first to be held on the Capitol's West Front, a symbolic gesture to Mr. Reagan's Western roots. There is time for the new president to revel in the history of the moment. Hail to the Chief is played for the new chief executive for the first time. And President Reagan acknowledges the cheers and applause of the 10,000 or so spectators lining the Capitol's West Front. In his inaugural address, President Reagan sounded a hopeful note. He called on Americans to begin an era of national renewal. He said it's time to realize, as he put it, we are too great a nation to limit ourselves to small dreams. In his speech, Mr. Reagan set out his priorities for the coming 4 years. Among other things, he set as a goal the control of the bureaucracy, as he put it, bringing the government back within its means.
The economic ills we suffer have come upon us over several decades. They will not go away in days, weeks, or months, but they will go away. They will go away because we have the capacity now, as we've had in the past, to do whatever needs to be done to preserve this last and greatest bastion of freedom. In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Mr. Reagan quickly added it was not his intention to do away with government. Rather, he said, it was his intention to make that government work. This is Merrily Cox.
Republican President Reagan used his charisma and charm early in his administration to win the confidence of Congress and the American people. His honeymoon with the Capitol Hill lawmakers lasted well beyond his first 100 days, despite Democratic control in the House. On March 30th, following a speech at a Washington hotel, he was greeted by a friendly crowd, light applause, and then gunfire. President Reagan had been shot while leaving the hotel in an assassination attempt. There were screams of fear and rage. Roger Gittins was on the scene when it happened.
President Reagan was leaving the Washington Hilton Hotel after a speech to a labor group. He waved to a small crowd waiting near his motorcade. Six shots rang out. Mr. Reagan was shoved into the safety of the bulletproof limousine. The car roared off, leaving behind three wounded men, a Secret Service agent, a D.C. police officer, and White House News Secretary Jim Brady. At first, it seemed that Mr. Reagan had escaped unscathed, but a few minutes later, he arrived at George Washington University Hospital. The president walked into the building but stumbled and went down on one knee before he was lifted to a stretcher. First official word on the president's condition came from Secretary of State Alexander Haig.
We have informed our friends abroad of the situation. The president's condition, as we know it, stable, now undergoing surgery.
But Haig, in the turmoil of the moment, made a misstep that would haunt him long after.
As of now, I am in control here.
Later, after the president left the operating room, his longtime aide, Lynn Nofziger, provided some extraordinary details about that harrowing afternoon.
He told Mrs. Reagan, honey, I forgot to duck. And then when he got into the operating room, he looked at the doctors and he said, please tell me you're Republicans.
Dr. Dennis O'Leary, the hospital spokesman, was equally upbeat in answering reporters' questions about the president's post-operative condition.
He was never in any serious danger. The bullet was really not very close to any vital structure.
O'Leary's account was on the rosy side. Mr. Reagan was in serious danger. But by early summer, the president was back to horseback riding and chopping wood. And there are two postscripts. John Hinckley, the accused assailant, attempted to hang himself, but was cut down in time. And Jim Brady, shot in the forehead, partially paralyzed, left the hospital for good just before Thanksgiving. His comeback described by doctors as nothing short of a miracle. This is Roger Gittins.
With those shots, life ended for Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, the architect of the peace treaty between his country and Israel, and the man considered to be America's closest ally in the Arab world. It was October 6th, the hot, sunny day. Sadat, dressed in the uniform of the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, was reviewing a military parade in a Cairo suburb. The parade had been going on for about 2 hours when the attackers struck. They apparently timed their assault to coincide with an aerial show by a squadron of jet fighters performing maneuvers. As officials in the reviewing stand looked to the skies above, a military vehicle traveling by the reviewing stand suddenly stopped. Four men jumped out and headed towards Sadat, throwing hand grenades and opening up with machine gun fire. Security guards fired back, but it was too late. Sadat had already been hit five times. He was rushed to a military hospital, but even the best Egyptian surgeons were unable to save him. He died on the operating table 2 hours later, and it was several more hours before the Egyptian government confirmed his death. Most of the attackers were killed or captured. A former Egyptian chief of staff and head of the Independent Organization for the Liberalization of Egypt and an archenemy of Sadat's Middle East policies claimed responsibility for the attack. In Beirut, Palestinian guerrillas celebrated Sadat's death by firing their weapons in the air. But other world leaders expressed shock, dismay, and sadness. Former President Jimmy Carter called Sadat a bold and courageous man. When word of Sadat's death reached the White House, President Reagan expressed his feelings about the Egyptian leader.
His courage and skill reaped a harvest of life for his nation and for the world. Anwar Sadat was admired and loved by the people of America. His death today, an act of infamy, cowardly infamy, fills us with horror. America has lost a close friend, the world has lost a great statesman, and mankind has lost a champion of peace.
Sadat was something of a maverick in the sphere of world diplomacy. He stunned both Arabs and Israelis by his determined pursuit of a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. The groundwork for that treaty was laid in early September of 1978 at Camp David, Maryland. Because of the violent way in which Sadat died, his funeral was almost one without mourners. World leaders who came to Egypt to pay last respects were under heavy security, and the police completely excluded the common people of Cairo from the funeral ceremony. A ceremony that began on the grounds of the Mahdi Hospital, where Sadat's family gathered for a brief prayer service, and ended at Egypt's Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Following a 21-gun salute, Sadat was laid to rest. With Sadat gone, there was speculation over whether U.S.-Egyptian relations would change. Sadat was a key in the Middle East negotiations. Early indications were that the new Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak, would follow in the shadow of Sadat, but without his power and charisma. But the violence didn't end there. On Wednesday, May 13th, while Pope John Paul II was addressing a late afternoon weekly general audience, a young Turk with a 9mm automatic tried to take the life of the head of the Roman Catholic Church. Jay Dyer arrived on the scene just a short while after it happened.
On Wednesday, the 13th of May, Pope John Paul II was holding his regular audience in St. Peter's Square on the edge of the Vatican City. The square was crowded with thousands of people, many reaching out and trying to touch him as he drove past in the white open truck known as the Popemobile. Then the unthinkable happened. Shots rang out and the Pope was sinking onto his side, a bright red stain spreading across his white cassock. Tourists Howard and Marianne Wheeler were in the crowd.
We were standing next to the fence, and the Pope was approaching and standing up in the Jeep. And I told my wife, Marianne, to put her hands up because he would be there in another 2 or 3 seconds. And I was taking pictures of him, and he was 10 feet away, and there were 2 shots. And the Pope crumpled over like this and looked up, very frightened, and then he fell down in the Jeep. And all pandemonium broke loose.
From where they were, they couldn't see the attacker, only hear him.
We didn't see him, but we heard the shots, and they were like firecrackers. The Pope, he looks just shocked, like, what happened? What's going on?
Others, however, did see the gunman. And for the police, it was more a matter of protecting the would-be assassin from the anger of the crowd than of arresting him. For the Pope, this day saw the start of a long battle for recovery, a battle that was to last most of the year. For the authorities, it was the start of an investigation that still remains inconclusive. After the shooting, the Pope was rushed to the Gemelli Hospital, where surgeons spent over 4 hours operating on the pontiff's intestines, which had suffered the worst damage in the shooting. The operation was successful, but it was to be many months before the Pope was once again fit enough to resume his travels. As to his assailant, the only thing about which there was no doubt was the fact that a 23-year-old Turk, Mehmet Ali Agca, fired the shots. Why he did it, however, and who, if anyone, was backing and helping him, remains a mystery. This is Jay Dyer reporting.
1981 will also be remembered for the hunger strikes by members of the Irish Republican Army in a bid to gain political status for IRA prisoners. The 2-month hunger strike by Bobby Sands, the IRA activist who was elected to the British Parliament, and the string of others that followed, proved to be a successful propaganda victory for the IRA. The Middle East continued to be a powder keg in 1981. Israeli troops involved in numerous border clashes with the Palestinian guerrillas in southern Lebanon. Targets were hit on both sides of the border, with the Israelis making deep penetrations inside Lebanon. One attack in Beirut left 25 civilians dead or injured. Early in May, it was discovered that Syria had set up anti-aircraft missiles in Lebanon. Damascus saying the missile sites were part of the defense system, established for the protection of its 22,000-man peacekeeping force in Lebanon. But Israel demanding the withdrawal of the missiles, claiming their presence represented a major threat to Israeli security. That tug of war dragged on for months. The United States sent Middle East emissary Philip Habib to the region to try and settle the dispute. On June 7th, Israeli warplanes stirred up an international controversy when they went on a bombing run and destroyed an Iraqi nuclear reactor near Baghdad. Tel Aviv again saying its security was being threatened. The U.S. State Department condemned the attack, saying Israel may have violated an agreement with the U.S. using American-made warplanes. And President Reagan said he would hold up the scheduled shipment of F-16 fighter planes to Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Begin insisted the attack was for defensive purposes. But the U.N. didn't see things his way, and on June 12th, the Security Council met in emergency session to debate the raid. A week later, the Council unanimously approved a resolution condemning Israel for the attack, but it failed to impose any sanctions. The U.S. boycott on the delivery of F-16 jets to Israel was looked on by many as a slap on the wrist, and they said because of the close ties between the two countries, it would be lifted in a short time. It appeared as though the administration was going to do just that. But then, in the middle of July, despite U.S. efforts to mediate a ceasefire in Lebanon, Israeli planes bombed more Palestinian targets in southern Lebanon and shot down a Syrian MiG. On July 17th, Lebanon requested an emergency session of the U.N. Security Council to discuss the widening Israeli attacks. It was in late July that Israel and the Palestinians agreed to a ceasefire. There were repeated violations, but by the middle of August, the fighting cooled down, the heat was off, and the U.S. was again ready to send those jets to Israel. In November, the U.S. and Israel signed an agreement of understanding, Washington promising limited defense protection in the event of outside aggression. Late in August, there was a dogfight in the skies over the Gulf of Sidra, north of Libya. It took about 60 seconds. When it was all over, two American F-14s had shot down two Libyan jet fighters. Later in the year, Libyan strongman Muammar Gaddafi, still fuming over the attack, reportedly equipped assassination teams and ordered them to kill top U.S. officials. Among those on the list, President Reagan, Vice President Bush, Secretary of State Haig, and Defense Secretary Weinberger. The proposed sale of American AWACS radar planes to Saudi Arabia stirred up quite a hornet's nest on Capitol Hill. That was in October. President Reagan standing strongly in favor of the sale, but meeting growing opposition from Congress. Rejection by both houses would have killed the sale. The House turned thumbs down on the proposal, and the Senate seemed to be leaning in the same direction. The president never gave up his campaign, lobbying right down to the last minute. And Pye Chamberlain reports on October 28th, the president's time and effort paid off.
The Senate was the focus of world attention. The hall so packed senators had trouble getting around. The chamber itself was packed. House members stood three deep along the walls as the clerk intoned the roll call. The second vote made clear the president had won. Andrews of South Dakota voted with the president. He'd been a key fence sitter. Actually, Republican leaders knew they had it when Cohen of Maine, who was half Jewish, announced for the sale. He said rejection could trigger a crisis in the Middle East, turn Europe against Israel, increase anti-Semitism in America. In the end, the president won by 52-48. He had two more votes in reserve. The consequence, if American-Saudi relations don't sour, in 4 years, the Saudis will pay $8.5 billion for five AWACS radar planes and related gear. The flying command centers will virtually double the power of the Saudi Air Force. And if the Reagan administration is right, the Saudis will join the peace process. Pye Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
You're listening to 1981 in Review. We'll continue after this message.
What is one way to discover early signs of systemic diseases like diabetes, high blood pressure, MS, brain tumor, or kidney disease? Are you ready for this? An eye exam. Hi, I'm Lyle Waggoner, and it's true that an ophthalmologist can look into your smiling Irish eyes and learn a great deal about you. He or she is a specialist who has graduated from medical school, spent a year interning, and then 3 years at a hospital as a resident in ophthalmology. An ophthalmologist can detect subtle changes in your eyes which may signal the beginning of such sight-threatening conditions as glaucoma or cataracts. Believe me, we can't afford to take our eyes for granted. Prescribing glasses or contact lenses is only a small part of eye care. Early diagnosis and treatment of a number of conditions are important. Folks over 40 should have regular eye exams. This is a public service message from the American Association of Ophthalmology and this station.
1981 was the year of Reaganomics. On February 5th, President Reagan told the nation, "The United States is in the worst economic mess since the Great Depression," and he appealed for support for sweeping spending and tax cuts. 2 weeks later, Mr. Reagan outlined his proposed $659 billion budget for fiscal 82. That spending plan provided for a $45 billion deficit, budget cuts totaling $41 billion, and an immediate 10% personal tax cut. Initially, opposition was strong, but the president used what some people called the greatest display of salesmanship in White House history to win congressional approval. The tax cut turned out to be the largest in U.S. history, cutting taxes 25% over a three-year period. But Mr. Reagan promised no quick fixes and said recovery would take time. The Federal Reserve Board continued its tight money policy as a means to control inflation, keeping interest rates at double-digit levels. This did cut down spending and pulled inflation down into the single-digit range. The housing industry suffered one of its worst periods since the end of World War II. Car sales also hit record lows. The Reagan economic plan suffered a setback in November when Budget Director David Stockman called the plan a Trojan horse which benefits the rich. Stockman apologized and offered his resignation, but the president decided to keep him on. At about the same time, there was another controversy involving the president's national security advisor, Richard Allen. Allen came under fire when it was learned he received $1,000 from a Japanese magazine for arranging an interview with First Lady Nancy Reagan. But the Justice Department cleared Allen of any wrongdoing, closing its investigation 2 weeks later.
This is James Buchanan in New York. 1981 saw change in Poland. The labor union Solidarity gained in power. Changes came in the Polish leadership. But the country remained plagued by its old problems: food shortages, lack of capital, and lack of hard goods. As the year neared its end, the communist military government declared martial law. Communications were severed between Poland and the outside world, and Russia remained a threat over the horizon. We'll return to Nick Charles and 1981 in review in just one moment.
What if you went off to college and found that you were different from everyone else, and everything was designed for them, not for you? Suppose you went to the library and all the books you needed were in Braille, and you were the only one who couldn't read. You'd feel left out, wouldn't you? And what if you went to class and found that there were no chairs because all the other students rolled in with their own wheelchairs? Suppose one of your professors gave his lectures talking with his hands, only his hands, and everyone understood sign language except you. You'd think it wasn't fair. Well, that's how handicapped people feel now when they go to college and find extra handicaps. But things are changing, and we have free information that can help. Write Closer Look, Box 1492, Washington, D.C., 20013. A public service message on behalf of the United States Office of Education.
On April 14th, the space shuttle Columbia touched down on a desert strip in California, beginning a new age in space. Bob Fuss relives that magic moment.
The nose wheel is down. The space shuttle has landed. What a magnificent sight it is out here. The chase planes came right down with it, and they're now flying off. The space shuttle Columbia, the first of its kind, has just made an absolutely picture-perfect landing on this dry lake bed.
7 months later to the day, another successful launch and landing. But James Buchanan tells us problems plagued the second mission.
It was around 1:18 Pacific time, Saturday, November 14th. Through a wispy cloud cover came the space shuttle Columbia, about to make history at 1:22 by becoming the first space vehicle to make a second landing on Earth. The second flight of Columbia was troubled, even before the launch. Originally scheduled to fly over a month earlier, tiles were broken when the coupling device failed. Then after those problems were fixed, another launch was scheduled. Then, November 4th, 31 seconds before launch, more
floor problems, a delay of a week. Finally, Thursday, November 12th, a picture-perfect second launch of Columbia. But after launch, the problems began. A failed fuel cell was the major problem. That was responsible for cutting short the planned five-day mission. And when that afternoon landing time was established, it was none too certain. Weather conditions were not optimum here at Edwards Air Force Base. Landing day began with a thick, high overcast. But by early afternoon, big blue patches of sky appeared, and there it was. Columbia gliding to a gentle touchdown on Rogers Dry Lake bed to become the first manned craft in history to fly into space and return to Earth twice. James Buchanan, Edwards Air Force Base, California.
NASA officials reported the completion of most of the shuttle's objectives and sent Columbia back to Cape Canaveral to prepare for its third launch. President Reagan, in the first major foreign policy speech, addressed the National Press Club in Washington and said the United States would not deploy its medium-range missiles if the Russians removed their missiles from Europe, an offer rejected by the Soviets, making the resumption of the arms reduction talks in Geneva more difficult. The United Nations demonstrated its inability to force the Soviet Union to remove its troops from Afghanistan, passing a resolution in the General Assembly calling for the withdrawal of those troops, but failing to exert any real pressure. And 70,000 Russian soldiers are still there. But the UN did have an opportunity to put a feather in its cap. On October 15th, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees for aiding homeless and displaced people around the world, the second time the agency had won the award. The United States won the lion's share of the other Nobel Prizes. On July 7th, President Reagan selected a woman as his first choice to succeed retiring Justice Potter Stewart on the U.S. Supreme Court. While he was running for president, Mr. Reagan promised one of his first appointments would be a woman. On September 21st, Pi Chamberlain reports, Sandra Day O'Connor, a 51-year-old Arizona Court of Appeals judge, won Senate confirmation and became the first woman in American history to be named to the U.S. Supreme Court.
The Vice President of the United States, the leaders of the Senate, the Attorney General stood and applauded as Sandra Day O'Connor walked out on the Senate steps facing the Supreme Court and delivered her opinion of the 99-0 vote for her confirmation as the first woman on the Supreme Court.
I'm absolutely overjoyed with the expression of support from the Senate.
Her views were generally conservative on busing, access of the poor to the courts, rights of criminal defendants, the death penalty. She was something of a feminist, having backed ERA, no-fault divorce, limited combat roles for women, having supported abortion in some cases, and withheld her legal opinion on abortion on demand. This had earned her bitter opposition from the new right. But the failure of the new right to develop a single vote against her had made liberal Democrats observe that the supposed political power of the new right might be less than many had thought. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
In the middle of November, Hollywood and the rest of the world heard of the death of actor William Holden at the age of 63. Holden, a veteran of 50 films, was found dead in his Santa Monica, California apartment after apparently falling and hitting his head on the edge of a bedside table. Actor Jimmy Stewart was a close friend.
Well, it came as a great shock to me because Bill has been very active in his profession in the last years, and he keeps going on, keeps making pictures. He's had a wonderful career as an actor. He's done some very fine work, and I hate to lose him.
Hollywood lost another top star, Natalie Wood. Her body was found floating near Santa Catalina Island, the 43-year-old actress and apparent drowning victim. The curtain also went down in 1981 on Bob Everly, a popular singer during the big band era. Actors Harry Von Zell and Jack Albertson, designer Edith Head, singers Hazel Scott and Harry Chapin, newsman Lowell Thomas, Israeli statesman Moshe Dayan, known for the patch over one eye, civil rights leader Roy Wilkins, former heavyweight champ Joe Louis, and Omar Bradley, the last of America's five-star generals. On July 29, 1981, Britain's Prince Charles ended his reign as the most eligible bachelor in the world. He was married to Lady Diana Spencer. In early November, Buckingham Palace announced that Princess Diana was expecting sometime in June. 1981 in Review. Written, produced, and narrated by Nick Charles. Technical supervisor, Bob Honig. This has been a presentation of the UPI Audio Network. 1981 in Review, a recap of the major news events of the year, can be heard on this station. This is Nick Charles. Hear the reports of those correspondents who were on the scene when the big news stories of the year were developing, and the voices of those who made the headlines on 1981 in Review.